why this darn thing is there. I can't get rid of it. Crap. I just have to deal with it. Okay. Are we there? Why is my laptop not showing up? Maybe I have to have it plugged in. I think that would matter.
So I asked Megan if she was going to go Monday.
Oh yeah. See what happens.
She's like, she's like, can I make them cry?
Oh yeah. Like, you can do that.
If that's what you're feeling.
That's what you want to do. Okay, why is this not functioning?
Make them question their futures and that.
That's what we do all the time. Oh, it's worse. How about this? Alright. Okay, so maybe we should get going. And we're, you know, behind today already because of the snow day and stuff. Hopefully, if you've seen the webpage, that you know you can download the podcast and Echo 360. Last time, Echo kind of cut out a little bit early for some odd reason, but everything's on podcast. So what I want to do first is, and hopefully you're following Canvas because you got an email from Dr. Daly with the lab about the safety thing. Have to do that, part of the university regulations and all that. So do that because your TAs will check to see that you did the online safety test, and then you could even do it on your phone, I think, something like that. Okay, so what I wanted to start off with is actually to try to get you your mind around how to study for this class, and I'm sure that all of you are like, well, I know that because I'm a junior or senior already, and we've gone through that. But actually, just to kind of reinforce it is important, I think. And actually, a lot of people are doing this in across the country in classes just to kind of make sure that we're on the same page. So this person came to UK last year. Really good. She gave a good seminar about learning and about reinforcing this point about learning. And I don't know why that little app down at the bottom won't go away on my computer screen, but it's just like stuck. Probably a virus on there. Alright, so let's think about how do we learn? This is really called metacognition and understanding how you think and how you learn. And it's really important. So everybody has different ways of learning. What's the best way that you find? Anybody? For studying, for learning? You're taking biochemistry or cell biology? What way do you... What's your approach? Anybody?
Write things down over and over again.
Write it down over and over? That's like me. I have to write it 100 times and then try to figure out what I wrote because I can't read my writing. Do some of you go through your PowerPoints, textbook, right? Try to cram the night before maybe, you know, 350 pages in that before and hope you remember it all. Does it work? No, right? You finally learned that now, about the fourth year, right? That doesn't work. And I've seen students over the years, remember I've been teaching for going on 22 years, some students that are really, I mean, they're like, what is that type called? A type, you know? They're just like way over the top, but they really covered everything that they wanted to learn in the class. So some years I've seen students with a textbook and they had a lot of highlights in it. Some years the students are really wanting to make a in this course or maybe the other courses that we teach, and they've really gone all out. And this is one way to make sure that you cover material. Remember, we don't have a signed textbook in here, but we did have suggested textbooks, and even older editions are okay too, so you can get some cheaper editions. But some students actually take the textbook, and like let's say we're covering metabolism. In respiration, and read the paragraph, stop, what did I just read? Was there any useful information in there? A little bullet point. Yes, glycolysis takes place in the cytoplasm. Boom, bullet point. Read the next paragraph. What's the bullet point that you want to get out of that? Read the next paragraph. And then you have notes, and maybe, you know, covering those notes, then that's your study guide, right? You don't have to reread the textbook. Now that might sound silly, but the students that have done that in the past, well, they've covered everything that we, you know, you hit.
and are like lectures, and you say, well, he went on a tangent there, but what was the meaning of that tangent? I do go on lots of tangents, but there's a meaning to the tangent. So that's why we go on some of those, to hopefully reinforce it. So think about the way that you learn the best and the way other people maybe around you that are doing really well and how they learn. Now, everybody's different. Some people can... When I went to college, I was rooming with a high school friend. I mean, he could read a textbook and read through the chapter and remember everything. And I was like, how in the hell did you remember all that? You know? And I'm sitting there making notes and studying it over and over again. But he could just remember things very quickly. But the next semester, you could have the next class, and we always took these classes together. I was a BS chemistry major, and we were covering these content, and he said, I don't remember that from last year. I said, no. Okay. But he could remember it really well, you know, right at the time, short-term memory, but completely forgot about what was happening, you know, a semester later. So think about things like that, what you use to learn the best, all right? And so let's just think about that. What's the difference between this? If you were, you know, to make an A on that test, what would you do? I mean, how would you think that it would be better? Just to study it? Or do you think that you actually got in the study group and had to rehearse that material over again? What way would be better for you to actually learn that material? Teaching it, I can tell you, would really be a better way to learn it, because then you have to understand it to be able to teach it, right? So this is important to think about, too. And you can even talk to your dog or your pet, or maybe, you know, put a stuffed animal on the table and talk to it or whatever. If you're in your own dorm room, they won't lock you up. But, you know, in the library, they might call the people with straitjackets to come talk to you. All right, so think about ways to learn. So let's just look at this really quick. So in the next couple of seconds, count how many vowels are in this context right there. Just try it out. Let's see how many vowels are there. And we'll time you somehow. 49. Okay, so this is just a point to think about, okay? And now let's go to the next question here. So how many words or phrases in there did you remember? Very few. And this is some reason why I don't like to put up the PowerPoints before class, because then it gives away some of the things that we're doing. But let's now look at this. Now, if we told you to know what types of words those were or the phrases, would you have a different way of studying? Right? This is the point I'm trying to make. So now look at that again. And if you were to try to remember these words, is there some pattern to this that you could maybe try to recall? Right? Does anybody get it? Anybody kind of slow this morning, didn't get your coffee? Right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. You got it? Right? Quarter of an hour, 12. Are we all together? Okay. So the point here is, what is it that you're trying to learn? What is it that you're trying to take home to remember? And if you know what that is, then it's really important and easier for you to study and retain that information. So the point is, what I'm trying to say is, when you're reading something, what is it that you're trying to get out of this content? What's the take-home message? So when you're looking at stuff, or even the PowerPoints, try to think about what are the main concepts that we're trying to cover and to learn. Don't get lost in the forest, is what I'm saying. All right, so this is basically the content of this. And this is called Bloom's Taxonomy. If you've never heard of this, you might hear about that later. Some of you want to be educators. Some of you want to be healthcare providers. Well, how are you going to teach the public to better their health, right? Are you going to start off, you know, talking about some scientific article and talk about, you know, content that's above them? Or are you going to try to work them through a learning paradigm to maybe better their health or stay on the antibiotic regimen? Why they're going to do that? So it's important, no matter what you're going to do, if you're going to be working with people and trying to educate them, either with healthcare or in a classroom, then you have to understand the levels of learning. And so basically, you know, this is what's called Bloom's Taxonomy, where you'll remember, understand it, apply it, analyzing it, evaluating it, and maybe even creating a way to reinforce that information. So just in case, I'm not going to test you on this content here, just to let you know, but this is the idea of learning. So when you're going through this class or any course, this might help you in your future or even in this course. So this is information that people have really collected over years too, and to be able to learn information or getting a good grade in the class. And it's really when people have to discuss information that they retain it a lot better. So that's been shown over and over again in many educational studies. Okay, so that's the main point I wanted to take home. And that, you know about your study program. The problem is everybody has different time frames, right? Some people are working. There are people in this class probably that have two jobs, plus taking a full load of school. Other people maybe just taking a full load of classes and not having the jobs or other things in the family to worry about. So everybody's different, and everybody has different personal aspects to, their life that they have to get through as well as studying. So there's lots of aspects in here to consider in your classmates or in college as a whole. I already went through that climbing video that we saw last time, and I didn't get through everything that I wanted to cover all last time when we were talking about, infection left in the finger. Remember in the heat, we covered that, right? And why you have localized heat. The idea is when you come up with something that's interesting, dive in and do the research, right? And look up information and immerse yourself. And then you go off and you realize that you spent 2 hours. Uh-oh. But you probably learned so much by going through there and digging down mechanisms of action. The last part I didn't cover about, like, what we were talking about with the temperature localized. Remember we talked about cytokines and cellular division and immune system that's hitting there, and the white blood cells are multiplying, bacteria is multiplying, and all that's chemical reactions, right? And that can raise that localized temperature. Let's just kind of follow that up. And I posted that on the webpage, the notes that I had that I was trying to get through. But the other point was then just to think about it. How about systemic infection and you have a fever? Why do you have a fever? The whole body fever. Why do you feel hot? Why does your body raise its set point, right? So these are things I want you to think about. How is it that you could raise your set point? Why do you have a fever in your body? Now, it's not talking about the localized infection anymore. It's talking about you've raised your body temperature, and now you're trying to raise your body temperature to a higher level. So maybe with an infection, a cold. Probably some people had the flu recently, right? And maybe you had a higher body temperature. Why did we have a fever? Anybody know what would be the benefit of a fever? Something so basic that we always have.
Raising the temperature helps kill off whatever the infection was?
Yeah, that's an idea that's out there, is that the higher the temperature, body temperature, would increase metabolism to increase white blood cell count, so then you could actually fight the infection. So that's been some of the ideas, but it's not substantiated completely. Not everybody's on board with that. But then you ask, okay, so maybe that's it. Raises your temperature so your body metabolism goes higher so you can make more white blood cells so you can fight that infection. But what made my body temperature go up? What made me think I needed a higher set point in my body temperature? Right now, your body temperature is what? Anybody know your body temperature about?
37 degrees.
30 what? 37 degrees Celsius. About 37 degrees Celsius, right? So, are we good?
Or is it warm? Yeah, it's
okay. All right. So why is it that it would go up to maybe 38? Or a higher temperature? What's the mechanism behind that? Anybody? Some negative feedback, but how does it happen, right? So this is what something very neat, right? Your body temperature does change throughout the day, too, and at night, it might drop a little bit at night. Your body temperature drops at night. If anybody's healthcare providers, and you're measuring people's temperature, you might see a drop at night. There's something, right? Unless they're having a scary nightmare or something, then the temperature might go up. But, so what is it that sets your body temperature? Pardon? Yes, like a homeostasis, that's setting it, this negative feedback, and we're going to talk about that. But there's a part in your brain, in your hypothalamus, where these neurons detect the temperature around them. So let's say your hand's a neuron here, and how does it know what temperature it needs to be at?
It's your receptors.
Some receptors. What kind of receptors? Some kind of sensory receptor. So it's a neuron membrane, and there's a receptor there. But how does it know what to do?
Communication direction potentials.
It's some kind of electrical event in that cell. But the mechanism of it, think about it. We just have a cell here. And how does it sense temperature?
So it's like sensory receptors go through the hypothalamus and that triggers it.
Yes, I'm going more basic. I'm saying we just have a cell, you're right. So we just have a cell and there's a receptor. But how does that receptor detect temperature? So this is where I want you to think about, going down to the very basic mechanisms. We miss these basic mechanisms all the time when we're studying, or you're studying science, or many concepts. There was a really good Nobel Prize winner, Richard Feynman. He got a Nobel Prize in physics. He loved teaching freshman physics. Why? Because he could start off at the very beginning, say, why do we have to memorize that formula? Where did that formula come from? And those formulas, people begin to realize, well, they're not really true. They kind of give you a generalization of it, but if you deep down deep enough, it's not really the full formula. There's lots of little exceptions, but you generalize. And he wanted to make sure people understand the basic concepts. So here we have the cell. We got a receptor in there, but how does it detect temperature? What do you think? What is a receptor made out of? Lipids? Carbohydrate? What is a receptor? Cell biology. We purged everything, right? We crammed the cell biology and dumped it all over this Christmas break. It's a protein, right? It's a protein. So it's a protein with a conformation. And that conformation is based on what? The structure. So this is what we're going to talk about at the end of this chapter. Structure of proteins. You know, primary, secondary, tertiary structure. The structure of that protein can change with temperature. And the structure of that protein, if it changes with its temperature, what could it do? Maybe trigger something inside the cell, the second messenger cascade. Or maybe that protein is an ion channel. And if it changes its conformation, it opens up and allows ions to go across the membrane. So this is where I want to get down to the basics, understanding how that cell might detect the temperature around it. And then you're right, in the sense that that could cause electrical event in the cell, ions might move in, cause an electrical depolarization, which we'll talk about, and then that could then fire and trigger other neurons in your body, and then cause you to try to raise your body temperature, maybe by shivering, right, which we're probably all doing this morning when we got outside. But then, again, you think about how does the bacterial infection in your body cause that receptor to change its conformation, to cause your set point to go up, right? So now we're wondering, how does that infection cause our receptor maybe to trigger that neuron to then start firing? You see where it goes? It's really quite neat to work out every little mechanism. And so people aren't quite even sure about that yet. Something so fundamental to every human being and every mammal, right? Body temperature. But not only that, invertebrates can sense temperature too. Think about your skin. Or maybe anybody ever eat a hot pepper and you put it on your mouth and you feel like, wow, this is hot, right? And you wonder, why are you burning? Why is your skin burning? Anybody have ideas?
Capsaicin,
right. So how is it that this chemical, you can rub it on your skin, it causes your skin to start feeling that it's burning, but the temperature didn't change at all, right? It's not the temperature that changed. It's just this chemical. What did it do? It activated that receptor that we were just talking about, a thermal receptor, a protein, and caused a conformational change. And it actually, it's called a trip receptor, opened up, allowed calcium to flow in, triggered that sensory neuron to fire, went to your brain and said, whoa, your skin out there is really hot. It's like been in the oven or something, right? But that capsaicin that's on there. And then that causes your body to say, you know, you're in a hot environment, but you're really not, right? So what happens if you eat hot, spicy food? What happens to you? Do you start to feel chilled? or you start to sweat, right? So it's really interesting. My wife's Korean, and she loves these Korean dishes called kimchi. They give me a GI blowout. But anyway, this hot food, she likes to eat it in the summer. It's a cultural aspect. And I said, why on earth would you want to eat hot, spicy food in the summer? This is crazy. You know, you want to eat it in the wintertime, right? Like hot chicken noodle soup or something. And she said, oh, no, it cools you down. And, you know, we've been married for 30 years now, really 31. And, you know, she still eats this kimchi in the hot days in the summer. And I just still shake my head. But I finally learned that it's probably not a bad idea, because what it does is it makes you sweat. And when you sweat, what happens? You have evaporative cooling. And you actually feel cooler afterwards. So it kind of cools you down. So culturally, I don't think they worried about the receptors being activated. It's a TRP receptor activated by capsaicin, but it actually cools you down in a hot day after you have this. But then you think about, how does this work? You eat a hot food, and this is, I know this is a tangent, but we're covering like the GI system later on, and this all fits together. So you eat the hot food, this capsaicin, right, it's in your stomach, goes across the stomach, the intestines, small intestines primarily, right? Gets into your bloodstream. Where does that go? Goes into your bloodstream, goes into your hypothalamus, and also throughout your body. And what is it doing? It's activating these TRP receptors. Isn't that cool? And those TRP receptors are no different, really, in your hypothalamus that can sense temperature than kind of, well, it's a little different isoform, but very similar, the ones on your skin that detect the capsaicin. And no really different than the ones that are in a C. elegans or a Drosophila. They're also TRP receptors, and they can detect temperature. So there's a whole family of TRP receptors, different isoforms, you know, just different protein sequences, but they do the same thing. They can detect temperature. And there's a whole family of them, from mammals to invertebrates, that can detect temperature. And they change how that cell functions and allow ions to move across. Now, that's pretty cool, right? Very cool. So this is the kind of thing to think about in comparative physiology. You can look at those throughout different animals, and then you can start to understand how you function as well. And we understand more about us because of studying animals, right? So this is the point, too, that I want to make. Okay, in Drosophila, I think there's almost 60 human diseases now that are modeled in Drosophila systems. Many neurological diseases and actually skeletal muscle diseases that occur that they can model in the system. Okay, so why are we studying physiology? Why are you in this course? Yes, it's a required course. That's why I'm here, right? And that's probably primary. But let's have some really interesting aspects to this. Why do people even study physiology or maybe study fruit flies? You know, it's kind of like, why study the Galapagos turtles, right? Or why study the migration of the Arctic tern? Is it going to help humankind? Probably not, but maybe understanding the world that you live in gives you a better appreciation of it as well. But then you never know what might happen. People probably didn't realize that studying that crazy mold that we were talking about, that bacterial mold that was on that sewage we talked about before, and then discovered cephalosporins that actually can treat a staph infection, right? Or a streptococci infection. All right, so it's pretty neat. You never know where it might go. So physiology, the study of living organisms, right? Do plants fall in this realm, right? There's a whole plant physiology course, too. The gods in the field of physiology a long time ago, they could study squid preparations, invertebrate preparations. And when those weren't available, guess what they did? They switched over to plants. Because some of the plant ion channels, like a sodium channel or a calcium channel, they're really not that much different than in a mammal, and then in a human. And so these people would look at pharmacological agents like TTX. Maybe you've heard of TTX, the puffer fish, right? It swells up, but people eat it. It's a delicacy in Japan, and the chef has to taste it, right? Get that numb feeling in their mouth. Hopefully not too much, but if the chef dies, then you know not to eat it, right? And so they test this out, and there are people that die every year from having this puffer fish. But when they were working on the mechanisms of action of that puffer fish and the TTX, they would actually work on animals during part of the year, and they would actually apply it on plants, too, to find out how the plants, you know, so what does that tell you about the ion channel from plants to humans? That it's similar, right? The TTX works the same way on that ion channel. Blocks a voltage-gated sodium channel. So understanding physiology in a comparative nature, not just in animals, but actually in all living organisms, is pretty neat to understand. And so it's pretty neat to understand these basic properties and understanding. I know you purged all your chemistry and physics and you say that was useless, but when you want to understand how the biology works, it usually comes down to the chemistry and physics. Remember, everything in biology and life sciences, if you couldn't explain it in a mathematical formula, it's really not explained yet, right? Everything in biology, everything in medicine and health, if you can't really put it to a number or a mathematical equation, then you really don't understand it fully. Think about it. Biochemistry, what do you look at? Rates of reaction, how fast? The KD, the rates, right? What drug dose do you give? A number, right? Everything comes down to really mathematics. If we haven't explained biological terms and mathematical terms, then it's not fully understood yet. So think about that when you're studying too, and that might help you to get down to the mechanisms of action, right? Okay, so this is where we wanted to go. These terms here, just to kind of, there's lots of memorization too, and I hate memorization, but to be able to talk the language, be able to understand what you're studying, there are, you know, a number of things that you have to memorize in every topic that you cover. We use these words kind of interchangeably and probably everyday talk or when you're talking through other classes, but actually we should be a little careful how we use these terms. Adaptation is this gradual change over many generations, right? So the evolutionary processes. And acclimatization is a change of an individual over its lifetime of biochemical alterations, where acclimation is more by experimentation. If we took animals or bacteria and we put it in the lab and we did testing under laboratory conditions, we would call it acclimation, right? Whereas if you looked at bacteria out in the real world and you wanted to see how that evolved over, you know, some changes with just maybe the temperature change really quickly in maybe its own life cycle, then that would be acclimation. But if you wanted to look over generations of, say, bacteria multiplying, 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 and then you have a different strain over time, that would be adaptation, all right? So these terms we should kind of be a little careful with, and some textbooks use these interchangeably, but just when we're, you know, taking exams or other things, we should think about this. All right, so Cannon, a person that we should kind of remember, coined this term, homeostasis, which some of you knew about, which is really good, and this is how we regulate our body temperature, our blood pressure, or many things in our body, and with other animals as well. So homeostasis is this regulation of whatever it might be, pH, temperature, ionic concentrations, osmolarity in your blood, for example, or temperature. And so it's around that set point that your body has set. And other people have different set points for different aspects, right? Or different animals. So let's think about this a little bit. When you're reading through different aspects or you're covering that content, you might say, oh, that fish is interesting. It only, its body temperature only changes a few degrees. But the issue is, if that fish has never been exposed to other temperatures, let's take some Arctic fish that lives around the, you know, Antarctica, and maybe it never experiences a higher temperature or a lower temperature. So if you measured it out in the environment, well, then you might say it can't handle any higher or lower temperature, but it's never been exposed to it, right? So that's the point to take, you know, in consideration too. Now, if you raise that temperature up, could it survive or not, right? And that's where you get into the experimentation point. So think about animals with their homeostatic regulation or other systems, even like you, and maybe your pH, and how much range you might be able to handle or your body can keep within a narrow window, for example. All right, so like temperature, salinity in your body. And like we said, this is mostly negative feedback processes. Now, some of you are, you know, pre-allied health, and you're going to be taking the MCAT test and our D test for dentistry school. And I've had students come back and say, thanks, Cooper, you've really covered everything that was on my MCAT, and, you know, it wasn't in the textbook. But I hear some of the students actually teach at Kaplan courses, and I try to make sure that even students that worked in the lab in the past, some of our former students, we have one student that's a second-year med student that's teaching in the Kaplan course, and he says, oh, yeah, we changed this. It's now they're kind of using this as an example, too, so I try to reinforce that and give that back to you as well. So this is standard types of questions on MCAT and D the dentistry exam and even the pharmacy exam about homeostasis and negative feedback. There are some examples with positive feedback. Can you think of some that you've probably heard of with positive feedback in the body? A common one. Which one? Birth. How is it in birth? Have you... And so this is with parturition, delivery, and the birth of a baby, right? So it stretches the uterus, right? And so how does that give the negative feedback then? But so how does it keep stretching it? Let's work through the details. So a baby, you know, going out, stretching the uterus, right? What does that trigger? Oxytocin, right? And oxytocin then is released, and that causes more contraction. So it pushes the baby more. And then it's going to stretch more, more oxytocin, more stretching, until parturation occurs and the baby's delivered. So it's that positive feedback of oxytocin. Now, what's a little confusing, but it's in those MCAT tests, is the action potential. So that's a new one that people are using too, and it's a little bit confusing. And it's not really so much a positive feedback, but they use that as an example as well. So if you don't see oxytocin and parturition with childbirthing, you might see a question with an action potential. And we'll go over why that's a little confusing a little bit later, but that's another example of positive feedback. All right, so hopefully that'll help. You know, when you talk about like salinity and your sodium levels or your potassium levels, and you know drink water, eat a lemon or whatever you do, orange, and you think about that salt that gets in your body, is that really a big problem? Sodium levels going up and down a little bit, maybe calcium going up and down a little bit? How tight of a regulation is that? When you go to the bathroom and you pee out, you know, your urine, and, you know, you're losing salts. What if you lose a little bit more of sodium? Is it going to be that big of an issue? Maybe. What ion is really quite important to regulate closely? Anybody else? What ion would you say out of these choices? Sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium? Real tight regulations in your blood, in your plasma too. Calcium somewhat, but calcium's so high outside the cell compared to inside cells, it doesn't matter that much. But what really matters, and you're going to notice this when you do your lab experiment with the crayfish muscle preparation, is potassium. Potassium is very critical to be regulated at a very tight window. You have too much potassium, your brain's going to go get excited and then shut down, as you'll learn about. Or if you have too low of potassium, then your heart and your brain can't work either. The nervous system can't work. So potassium's really quite critical. But you think of other ions can go at a much wider range. So potassium has a very narrow window that can be in your body. Otherwise, you're going to have lots of problems. All right? We'll talk more about that later. Okay. So negative feedback, positive feedback, just like your thermostat. Kind of you've known about that. So let's think about these animals like a regulator and a conformer, right? When you think about a regulator, we're talking about some homeostatic regulation, right? Like maintaining your pH or maintaining your body temperature, like we talked about with the set point. But a conformer then conforms to their environment. And usually we think about conformers like invertebrates, right? The worm, the crayfish, beautiful animal. Everybody's going to probably get a crayfish tattoo by the end of the class. So they're really quite neat. But you think about, do these animals just conform to their environment? If the temperature raises, do they just raise their body temperature? They're conformed to their environment. But think about it. They can actually try to control their body temperature by behaviors. They can actually seek out an environment that's cooler or warmer. If you put like invertebrates, like the lobsters or crayfish, in a tank and you give them a thermocline, they will tend to choose a particular area of temperature that they're most comfortable at. So they're not just, you know, willy-nilly. They actually have a place of temperature that they prefer. So yes, they can conform to that environment, but they might have behavioral changes to try to regulate. So that's kind of neat to think about. So it's not so black and white as you might think. All right. this is a really important term that we should think about, this homeostasis in regulation, to make sure we understand it, because that's the fundamentals throughout this whole class, really, is homeostasis and trying to maintain a physiological level. So if you get out of that physiological level, then where are you? In a pathological state, right? So pathology is an abnormal physiology. But how do you know that somebody or something is pathological? How could you know if it's pathological? That means you have to know what is normal, right? So the normal physiology has to be understood before you can understand the disease state or something of that nature or pathological state. Okay. So what people have done, like we've mentioned, is that you find a suitable animal to try to understand that physiological system. A really good example was the squid system, right? The squid. And what did they get from the squid? They have gigantic nerves. And the axons are so large, they're like the diameter of your pinky or a pencil. They could take that axon out of the animal, put it into a dish. They could actually roll the axon like a toothpaste and push the toothpaste out of the axon, tie off one end, and fill it with whatever solution they wanted to. And then put a wire in there and tie that off. And now they could put that whole axon into a saline dish. And actually, a long time ago, they just used seawater. It was kind of serendipitously that actually seawater mimicked really well the extracellular fluid inside the squid around this neuron. So they could actually do studies on it. And this is way before you had intracellular electrodes. This is back in the early 1950s. I know, a long time ago. It's not really that long ago when you think about it. And they could actually, then they'd use the squid to understand how the nervous system works, which understood how you work, right? So the squid is this prime example of this August Croak principle, finding an ideal animal to begin to investigate things. It's kind of like using a desert kangaroo rat. It's really neat. One time I took my kids out camping. We went through Wyoming and Utah, went to this little museum, and I was so excited because I hadn't seen a little desert kangaroo rat up close, but they had one stuffed in this you know, glass cabinet, and my kids were saying, come on, Dad, you know, we're hungry. And I said, oh, this is so cool. Look at this little desert kangaroo rat, because we talk about it, but we never, you know, I never really seen one. So these animals are phenomenal, and it does fit with what we're talking about in biochemistry, is that they don't have to drink water. They never have to drink water. Isn't that amazing? They could just eat seeds, little seeds, and they get a little bit of moisture out of the seeds, about 10% they figured out, so they can give them these little seeds, and there's just a little bit of moisture in there. But they survive without ever having to drink water. Just get a little moisture from the seeds. How long do you think you'd survive without having any drinking fluids? Not really that long. Anybody know how they survive? How they make water? Did we have anybody take biochemistry in here? Anybody take biochemistry? Ah, yes, we took biochemistry. Did we purge it all, or do we remember some? No, purged all. It's that cramming, right? What happens? What's the reaction? That you could get a tattoo. This is a really cool tattoo. It's much better than most butterfly tattoos. Yes. So what's that reaction? C6H12O6 plus 6O2, right? Equals or goes to what? 6 CO2s, right? Plus, what was the other thing? Plus water, right? And then you can add plus temperature on top of that, right? So that water that's made by the breakdown, if you don't remember what C6H12O6 is, go to Wikipedia today, okay? But that might be your tattoo that you'd like to get, all right? And that byproduct of this is CO2 and water, right? That water is called metabolic water because you metabolize carbohydrates to get to that water. And the desert kangaroo rat makes enough metabolic water to survive. You make water breaking down that spaghetti that you had last night, right? You're making water from that. Isn't that cool? That's really cool. That's very cool. All right. And you made CO2 as well, right? Made CO2. What happened to that CO2? Pardon? You breathe it out. And you're making it in your cells, right? Inside your cells, you're breaking down that glucose. You're making water inside the cell. So what happens to the cell? Does it just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger? No. Then it has to regulate the water. What happens to the ions in that cell if it makes the water? Dilutes them, right? So you've got to get the water out to keep the ion concentration, right? The CO2 can go right across the bilipid membrane. So it goes out of the bilipid membrane of the cell. And where does it go? The next cell, next cell, next cell. Finally gets into the bloodstream. We'll talk about that. And then you blow it out. Isn't that cool? It's really cool to think about. All that's happening in the cell. But when you break down that protein or those carbohydrates, that cell that's making that CO2, the CO2's coming out. How does it know to go out your lungs? Right? How does it know to regulate this level? And this is what we're going to talk about when we talk about respiration. So just keep all these things in your mind. It's really quite cool. I get off on craziness. So I have to think about wild things. So we got a little exercise for you. Let's see if this will still work. I think it'll work. It's a fun thing. Not too stressful. Okay, so we have this question here. The chicken and egg question. Maybe you had this before. Have you ever heard this one? No? So let's look at this. We have a chicken egg. It's fertilized. We're going to put it on a scale here. All right? Now, if you know the answer, don't tell your friends yet. All right, so you have this egg. You put it on a scale. It's fertilized. Now, you're going to let that egg, and it's a warm enough environment, let's say it's a warm enough environment, for that fertilized egg to develop into the little chick. And then right before it starts pecking on the shell and cracks open the shell, you're going to weigh it again. So does the weight of that egg, does it gain mass before it hatches? I think the egg will lose mass before it hatches. Or I think it's going to stay the same. So what do you think? Now, maybe if you know the answer, that's cool. But if you don't, that's all right. These are called plickers. This is saving you $14 or $20 because these are little free things for you to get the right answer. So you will see on the other side, it's A if you hold it that way, B if you hold it that way, C if you hold it that way. And I go around with my cell phone, and I take a picture of your QR code. So you can get in some groups, and we'll pass these around, and I'm going to take some pictures, and we're going to get some interesting answers out of it.
Yeah. Oh, this is like a big master.
Let's go find out what we got. Reveal answers. I need answers. Reveal answers. How about the reports? Classes. New lives. What's happening here?
I thought you said
he doesn't want to change.
He doesn't want to change. Oh, here we go.
Reveal answers. There you go.
That didn't work. Why is that? Maybe I have to go to class. Let me go back to classes and see what happens. Okay. Well, it's not revealing it on there, but what we got is, and maybe some people held the cards wrong, we got 3 A's, 1 B, 14 C's. All right? And I think one card got messed up. But see, so I think the mass. So the majority of you said I think the mass of the egg stays the same as the chick develops inside. And the majority of the class thought that, right? Let me pick up flicker cards in a little bit. So the majority of the class says the egg will not change mass. Guess what? I teach teacher workshops across the state, and I've been doing that for 10 years or more for high school science teachers, and we've done this test with them, and they teach cell biology, physiology, and just like us, any of you had cell biology, right? So raise your hand if you had cell. Alright, so, guess what? As you metabolize, what is happening? What did we just talk about? I gave you a hint ahead of time that you produce CO2. Where does that CO2 go to? Does CO2 have any weight? No weight? CO2 has no weight? Carbon? Oxygen? Two oxygen? Carbon has no weight? What did we learn in chemistry? Molecular weights, right? So guess what happens? This is a misconception that we have. So your school teachers got this wrong as well. And we got this wrong as well, right? That egg loses weight because the CO2 goes away. If you didn't eat any food right now, you're eating apples, so that one counts. But What if you didn't eat any food today, and you didn't poop or pee, right? So you didn't excrete anything. And you're walking around, and you're running between classes, and you're trying to stay warm, and you're shivering. Do you think your weight changed at all? You didn't eat anything. You didn't poop or pee. You might have sweated a little bit, right? Maybe you lost a little bit of weight from evaporation. And from breathing, because it's cold outside, that moist air is going out. But guess what? You metabolized today, right? You broke down glycogen, or maybe proteins, or maybe some fat. And what happens when you go through glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain? That end product was CO2 that was being liberated in heat. And CO2, did it stay in your body? You breathed it out. But you breathed in oxygen too, right? So you took in oxygen, maybe even made some proteins. But you've actually lost weight. And if you don't eat, you know, what's going to happen over days if you don't eat, you're going to lose weight, right? And so why did you lose that weight, and where does it go to throughout the day? Did you know you just lost weight by breathing out CO2? Isn't that amazing? That's really amazing. I wish I could. I'm skinnier. No, it doesn't happen. I try to do it. It doesn't work. Right? And so you think about it, and so this is really quite cool. So now you go back and you think about, whoa, what did I learn in cell biology? What did I learn in all that glycolysis, TCA, and electron transport chain? How can I put that into a practical application? Well, right here is a good example of that, right? So you get lost by studying all those little reactions but not putting it into the big picture. This is where I want you to understand the big picture. So people have been interested in this in the 1500s. I forgot the guy that did this experiment. Maybe I talked about it in your ecology class. He took a little acorn, go outside and take an acorn. You know, you can do this experiment, but you're already, you know, I was about to say, put it in your dorm room, wait until you graduate, you know, try this experiment out. But it was done like hundreds of years ago. Took like an acorn, put it in the soil, in his pot. He weighed his soil, right? And he put the acorn in there, whatever the seed was. I'm just using acorn as an example. And it grew. And he let it keep growing. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger. Right? So now you have this kind of tree, right? So he thought, okay, let's find out where all this weight came from. This tree weighs a lot. He took the tree out of the pot, shook off all the dirt, weighed the dirt again, weighed the tree. The tree is really heavy now, right? Heavy tree. And weighed the dirt, and he found out the dirt really didn't change that much. It's pretty much the same weight as he started with. Where did all that weight come from in the tree? The dirt really didn't change. It didn't make up for the weight of the tree. My gosh. So the only thing he added to this to keep the tree alive is what? Water. So he said the tree gained the weight by the water. So it's all water. Now, what do we know about this? Nowadays, hundreds of years later, where did that weight really come from? CO2, right? And oxygen and things like that. So that CO2 that it used to then make metabolism in its cells gain the weight, and that CO2 that's in your body too is recycled as well. And it's not just all blown out, but it actually can be utilized. So when you think about these examples, you could have a misconception because he only thought about the water. He didn't understand about metabolism and how the plants could actually gain mass. But now you think about, wow, trees are really heavy. And where did all that weight come from? CO2, right? So it's really quite amazing to think about these things. All right, so I know I went off on crazy tangents, but that's the way we do. So hopefully that was a good learning lesson a bit about things. Now I'll get this to behave. All right, so I'm going to kind of go through this a little bit quick, and because it should be a little bit of a review for one thing, but it's not a lot to really remember. The take-home. Remember, the take-home message is pretty quick. So with these exercises that we went through and these tangents, hopefully this is really reinforced about understanding the cellular level and understanding how you get energy. So let's just think about different ways that the cells can get energy. Carbohydrates, you know, like glucose, right? And you talk about glycogen, the storage molecule of glucose. You can get energy out of lipids. I wish I could get some more energy out of that by breaking them down. But anyways, you can actually get lipids, and we'll talk about that. We'll get energy from lipid breakdown metabolism. And that's important when you think about various animals, migratory animals, for example. don't really want to store glucose. They want to store some lipids and glycogen. And when you store lipids, it's really good because it doesn't take a lot of weight. It doesn't take water along with it. So you don't need water to go along with lipids. I try to use that excuse all the time with my wife. It doesn't work. And I just don't want to gain all the water. That's why I'm trying to put in, you know, more lipids. All right. So other aspects that you can get energy from proteins as well. You break down proteins to amino acids, and those amino acids can enter into those metabolic cycles that we're going to talk about, and then you can get energy out of those as well. If you don't eat, and you use up your glycogen stores, and use up your fat stores, guess what's going to be starting to break down? Your muscle, right? And you can get energy out of your muscle. But you'll use, hopefully, your other resources first. All right, and then other things that are in your cell, like nucleic acids and DNA and RNA, right?
Okay, so
let's just remember where all this is taking place. I know you've purged this. You've probably seen these crazy diagrams forever. But, you know, where do all these things take place, and where is this machinery going on? And we're not going to go back and rehearse everything that you had in cell, but the cytoplasm, the mitochondria, the Christie of the mitochondria is what we're focusing on right now for the next few minutes. Okay, so when we talk about that, you know, nucleus, right, DNA in there, and it's really quite interesting because it used to be thought that all proteins were made in the cytoplasm within the nucleus, I mean within the cell body of the of an organism, like in a neuron, and that all those proteins are made in the cell body of, say, your spinal motor neuron. But your cell body is up here in your spinal cord, but the axon goes all the way down to your big toe, right? That's really the longest cell in your body. Think of that nerve. The cell body's up in your spinal cord, and that axon goes all the way down to your big toe, right? And the cell body's for your sensory neurons in your big toe. The sensory endings are down there, but the cell bodies for your sensory neurons are where? In your dorsal root ganglion, right at the base of your vertebrae. The cell body's there. So it takes a long time to make proteins and transport them down there. But they found out that when I was in school, you couldn't have a localized protein synthesis. But now they understand that there are ribosomes, like in the axon nerve terminal, and you can actually make proteins in the nerve terminal and even in the dendrites of neurons. So it doesn't all have to go to the cell body. So it's kind of a change in the way that people were thinking about things. Okay. So just that you might want to refresh yourself, because this could be on your standardized exams too, about translation and transcription and how proteins are made. So I'm not going to go through all that, but I put that in the PowerPoint so you have it for your review, right? And then finally we get this final protein. And like we talked about last time, a single point mutation can really make a big difference in somebody, right? Many ion pathologies of ion channels that don't work right, and you think about it, what if an ion channel, like a sodium channel, wasn't made right when you were a fetus, when you're growing up? Right, did we talk about that already? No, yes, I can't remember what I talked about from year to year. Flax. So when you think about, I think there was a study done down at Vanderbilt when they were actually looking at mothers that were getting pregnant, right? You take a little P test and, you know, what is it, a blue thing, blue cross now, red negative line or something like that. But the so you get pregnant, you're pregnant, you have a fertilized creature inside of you growing, right? It's like a little parasite, takes all your energy away from you. But they follow that up and they find out that a lot of those pregnancies, this is why a lot of women won't want to say that they're pregnant yet until maybe past the first trimester or so, because you might not keep the baby, right? Can happen. But they found out that when they look at mothers that are actually identified early on that they're pregnant, that about 50% of pregnancies end up in spontaneous abortions. So that's natural, right? Spontaneous abortions. Why does that happen? So don't worry about abortions so much. It's spontaneously, it happens greater, and one study was actually more than 50% of fertilized embryos were just spontaneously aborted. But why would that happen? What do you think? Didn't check all the boxes. That's a good point. Something didn't go right. But think about it. If an ion channel didn't develop right, like a calcium channel or a sodium channel, what happens to the fetal heart? It's not going to work right. It's not going to beat right. it's not going to circulate the blood. And then if you don't get circulation of the blood, you don't get nutrients to the cells. And then what happens? They don't survive, right? They die out. And then that fetus doesn't survive, and it can actually be reabsorbed in the mother. Or might have a spontaneous abortion, and it's relieved. But it, a lot of times, babies are actually just reabsorbed. Fetuses are reabsorbed, all right, in the mothers. So when you think about it, you think about, whoa. So what they're trying to do is to find out why sometimes babies die in a mother, and then they'll go in and actually do a C-section, take that baby out, but do a genetic test and find out why did that baby die. And a lot of times they find out it's an ion channel pathology, such as like calcium channels or sodium channels or potassium channels that didn't develop right. Because in some cases it could be a single amino acid substitution, in making that protein. Isn't that amazing? It might be the pore of the ion channel doesn't work right. Or you can have mutations, and we probably have some, maybe I have some too. Maybe some other amino acids aren't right, but it doesn't cause a big problem, right? It might be on the extracellular side. So some of that sequence in the proteins are very important, and others, not so important. There's some structure, right, to it. So when you think about these, this is what people try to understand, the biochemistry, the reactions. Why is that particular amino acid so important? If you had a substitution or that one's deleted, it could end up in lethality. All right. So this is why people play with like Drosophila, C. elegans, other animals, model animals. They can make these point mutations, mimic a human disease, correct that gene therapy, you know, like with gene therapy, and see if you can correct the problem. And this is what people do, modern day science. Probably people have heard of CRISPR-9, right? So they're trying to specifically target things that have gone amok in development, and can correct gene mutations. And that's pretty cool, too. All right, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time with all that. But to understand the mitochondria, too, is really important, right, and the processes that go on in the mitochondria. And remember, you see this kind of mitochondria like that in general, but a lot of mitochondria don't have that shape. Actually, some mitochondria can be very long, with little branches, kind of like, whoa, really? And you wonder about what gives the structure of mitochondria. Here's a really weird thing for you. A nerve terminal going to a skeletal muscle in your body, you do a section in there, you look at the nerve terminal, and the mitochondria are really, really small. Tiny little mitochondria inside the nerve terminals. Very small. Now, just go to the next tissue over and look in the muscle. The mitochondria are gigantic. Gigantic compared, they're as big as the nerve terminal. So why is the mitochondria so small in the nerve terminal, but so big in a muscle fiber? And maybe it needs more, it's working harder or something, but the nerve terminal is very energetically demanding, right? So you wonder what gives structure to that. I mean, people haven't really been able to resolve that question. Isn't that wild? Where did mitochondria come from when you? Did it come from your dad and your mom?
Mom.
Mom, right? So all your mitochondria came from your mom, and, you know, why is it so different as the cells differentiated? That's kind of interesting. Does that happen in all animals? Mitochondria always from the mom? Where is that coming from? The egg, right? How could you get it from the dad, right? Where, from kissing the mother, and then it goes into the mother's egg. Joking, making sure you're paying attention. All right. But the sperm, actually, in some animals, the sperm, when it hits the egg and fertilizes, in some animals, particularly like leeches, the sperm actually can give a mitochondria to the egg. And so in some animals, actually the mitochondria can be mixed from the mother and the father in that fertilization. So it's kind of interesting, it's not always the case that it's maternal. All right. So we're going to talk about anaerobic and aerobic processes. Anaerobic means without oxygen, and aerobic with oxygen. And basically, what are we trying to produce? ATP, right? The powerhouse of the cell, the mitochondria, right? ATP. Okay. So let's put on our thinking hats. You made ATP, great. Why is that ATP energy? Why do we call that the energy of the cell? Why are we trying to make ATP? What, this whole process we're going to talk about, how many ATP are made, you've memorized all that in biochemistry and stuff, but why do you make ATP? Why is that
ATP?
An so you can have ATP.
It has high energy bonds that you can break.
It has high energy bonds that can break. When you break that bond, what do you produce? Heat. Do you just want to make heat in your body? And these are great. I love discussion. I'm not
jump on you for the wrong answers or anything, because that's what, you know, we need to discuss this. So why is ATP an energy molecule? It can make heat. If you're shivering, you're not trying to make proteins, right? Your muscles are shivering. Basically, to use up, like, glucose and make ATP, but it's not for really muscle contraction all the time. I mean, you're shivering and it's giving you the muscle contraction, but what are you doing? You're raising your body temperature. It's not for, like, work, right? And brown fat, basically, it's the same idea. Brown fat can be metabolized, and it can make ATP, and it's basically just to produce heat. Like, it's like the baby has brown fat between their shoulder blades in the back, and that's to keep them warm. But what does ATP do for you? Why is it an energy molecule? Why do we want to, if we had a bottle of ATP here, would it just explode? You know, is it so full of energy, it's as powerful, it's going to just pop? No? Okay. So what does ATP do in the cell? Why do we have ATP? Why do we need ATP? Anybody? No? Yes? Gives off light? No? So if we had a bottle of ATP, why is that useful? Come on. Ideas? The breaking the bonds are a really good one so far. You're right on the right track. So he's saying that you use that phosphate to do other things. You break it off the ATP and it can be used for other things. So how does it work? Like muscle contraction, how does that phosphate do anything? And how does that happen to make the word? You just said the word. Starts with E. I think you said it.
Phosphorylation.
That's the key right there. You take that phosphate off, it can bind to another structure. It can bind to a protein. It can bind to an enzyme. It can turn on second messengers in the cell. Your sodium-potassium pump, that's in your every cell in your body pretty much. As far as I know, it's in every cell of your body. If you find otherwise, let me know. But what does it do? It takes that phosphate off. It can bind to that protein or that enzyme, change its conformation by phosphorylation, because that phosphorylation on an amino acid changes its structure. It can either activate that enzyme or maybe even turn it off or turn on a second messenger cascade that then can trigger many different things that go on, right, in itself. So probably the most energy-demanding process in your body, test questions. Everybody wake up, test questions. What's probably the most energy-demanding process in your body right now just sitting there? What kind of cellular process do you think might be the most energy-demanding process in your body? Any idea?
Respiration.
Respiration, in a sense, like, you know, breaking down glycolysis to make the ATP, but to maintain that homeostatic process, because you have to get that energy to do that. Cell replication, that would take a lot of energy, but just sitting right here, we're probably not dividing that many cells that fast, unless we have a bacterial infection, it might be. Or little culture systems in our body. But think about, your eyes are working, right? Your neurons are working, your heart's working, your muscles might be working, maybe help to hold your head up from falling asleep. But then you think about what's going on in those cells to keep those neurons working, or to keep those muscles working, or to keep your heart contracting, or to make urine, or to absorb that energy. Brain function, that's a good point. So the brain function, like I have about like a million neurons in each eye, your retinal nerve is going out. Your optic nerve is about a million neurons in each eye, so that's like 2 million neurons. You're seeing something. So that energy is being used. How is it that you're seeing things? You know, light's being going into your eye, hitting some molecule that causes the conformation, and then causing this electrical event in that cell. And those electrical events have to travel on through, and then it keeps your brain going, you're thinking. You know, this crazy guy, what's he talking about? But you think about that, well, if you get ions to move into a cell or out of a cell, what happens over time into that cell? If ions are going in, like sodium's going in or potassium's going out, or vice versa, what's going to happen over time? It's going to cause an imbalance, right? What keeps that balance going? Pumps, right? Sodium-potassium pump or the sodium-potassium, right? Calcium pumps, you have lots of different things, exchangers.
The sodium potassium pump, you remember that test question from high school, but it's on your MCATs and all that other stuff too. How many sodiums to how many potassiums?
2 to 3, 3 to 2, 4 to 5,
what? 3 what? Yes, 3 sodiums to 2 potassiums, is that it? 3 to 2, guess what? That's just a generalization. It doesn't really, it's not really that. It, in some cells, it's thought to be like 4 to 2, or maybe 3.5 to 2 point something. But in general, it's 3.3 to 2. But it's not really just 3 sodiums to 2 potassiums. On average, it kind of comes out that. But that's probably the most energy-demanding process in your body right now, is to keep that pump working. And how does that pump work? By ATP. By phosphorylating that pump. Allows that pump to work. So if you don't make ATP, guess what happens to your pump? It doesn't work. And what's going to happen to your cells? They're going to be messed up, and then they become leaky, and then what happens? They die, and then you die, right? And so if you poisoned your mitochondria from making ATP, what's probably going to happen to you initially? You're breathing, right? Maybe your brain's kind of going, but if your neurons can't work to contract your diaphragm, right, for breathing, right, you stop breathing, and then what happens? That's it. And so, that's really great stuff, right, to go home thinking about dying. But this used to happen a lot with back in my days in college, people would end up with at the end of the dorm year or whatever you're in the dorm, and people had water beds and all that kind of crazy stuff and glow lamps, you know, and all that. That's the generation I come from. But at the end of the semester, people would empty out their water beds. In some apartments, it was such a big thing that they would make you sign contracts that you wouldn't have a water bed because it would cause problems and leaks and all that, and go through 3 floors. We weren't allowed to have them in dorm rooms, but people snuck them in anyway, so all that kind of good stuff. But at the end of the semester, people would want to drain them out, right? So what do? You hook up your hose, and then you put it out the window. Hopefully it doesn't go into the neighbor's window. Or down into the bathtub or something like that. And people would end up in the ER. Why would they end up in the ER? From doing this. Maybe bacteria. But really, it wasn't so much the bacteria, because what did you add? And we're going to talk about it. I probably don't have time because it's a crazy tangent. Is you would add a mold inhibitor, an azide inhibitor. And the azide would block the respiratory chain, the electron transport chain in the mitochondria. And when you took a swig of that, you might swallow a little bit of it, you don't taste it. And then you got it in your body, it goes across your GI tract, gets in your body, and now you're feeling like weak as could be. And if you don't get to the ER, you're probably going to die, right? So it's really quite bad stuff. And a lot of people died from the azide inhibitor. And if anybody works in a lab, anybody work in a lab? Possibly, right? Anybody ever use a pH meter? Right? And you balance your pH, you calibrate your pH meter with the buffers that are sitting on the shelves. And, you know, they're sitting there for years. And you're wondering, why is nothing growing in those things, right? Guess what they put in there? Azide inhibitors. Mold inhibitors. So, if you're working in a lab, and we had an undergraduate 1 year that was working in our lab, made crayfish saline. For the wonderful animals they are. And we were actually going to study synaptic transmission, and the prep would just start dying over time. I thought, well, something's wrong. Maybe I didn't teach the student right, it's my fault, didn't make the saline right. So we went through and made it all together. She weighed it all out right. It wasn't, you can get calcium mixed up with potassium or something. And it was all good. And then we went to pH it, and I saw how she pH'd. She used the pH electrode, she put it in the buffer, calibrated the machine, right? And then took that electrode out and then put it right into the saline that she was going to pH. Where was the fatal mistake? What was on that pH electrode was the azides for a small volume of crayfish saline we were making. And that got into the crayfish saline and then killed our preparation in time. A simple little forgetting to wash off the pH electrode killed our preps. Pretty neat to think about. It all brought back the memories of what, you know, people are dying and why they died with water beds. Bad things. Okay, so energy, ATP, is that phosphate and heat, right, that we're talking about. That phosphate for phosphorylation of proteins, pumps, ion channels, all neat stuff that we're going to talk about. So yes, we want you to go through this and understand where these processes take place. I don't want you to have to memorize an absolute number here, because that's not really important. It's, in some textbooks, they'll show you 36, 34, 38 ATPs. It's a general number, just like 3 to 2. But in general, you're making in the 30s of ATP. And why does it vary? Because some of these processes vary in the metabolism. But I want you to go away with understanding something, that glucose is broken down to pyruvate. Where does glycolysis take place? Cytoplasm. Test question. MCAT type test question. Pyruvate to the TCA cycle. And here's a take home, just to remember. TCA cycle, also called the Krebs cycle. All right? So don't get confused. Also called the citric acid cycle. People get confused and said, which cycle wasn't I supposed to remember? Was it the Krebs or the TCA cycle? It's the same. Hans Krebs was the discoverer of this. He described it, and it's named after him. So Krebs, TCA, citric acid cycle, all the same. Synonymous. You go through that, and then you go through the electron transport chain. The electron transport chain is where you make most of your ATP, okay? So this is where you're making most of your ATP. Where does the TCA electron transport chain take place? Mitochondria, the take-home, okay? So don't try to memorize all the different little things that are coming out of here, but that's the take-home that we want to make sure that you remember. Okay, see you on Tuesday, right? But you have labs on Monday, right? So
I have mine on Wednesday.
Okay, some people have labs on Monday. All right.